Hello, welcome to the Restless History members bonus episode, and I am back from my travels. I'm so sorry, I've been away for I think 4 weeks now. And what do you know, Dominic's gone off on his travels. I think he's gone to Constantinople with Arthur for half term. However, I have incredibly exciting news about the person who's going to be joining me just for 5 minutes on this episode. And it's the very first time that we've had a historical figure who has featured in one of our podcasts turn up on one of the members' episodes. So it's a bit like getting Cleopatra or Nelson or Abraham Lincoln. It's the 27th Prime Minister of Australia. She signed herself as a proud Wang. It's Julia Gillard. Julia, thank you so much for joining us. And especially after Dominic was incredibly rude about you in describing you as the Guardian in human form.
Well, Tom, I'm glad to join you, to be put in company like that, Cleopatra, Lincoln. Of course, I'd want to join you. And I didn't take any offence when Dominic did describe me as the Guardian come to life. As I think you know, I sent an email in saying, I'm not sure that's right, but it's certainly not the worst thing I've ever been called.
We were a lot ruder about Tony Abbott, weren't we? So
I think you were a lot ruder about Tony Abbott.
I'd also just wanted to ask you, in the account of your career that we gave on our tour, our romp through the history of Australian prime ministers, I said that when you were coming over from Wales to Australia as a young girl, you've been given a toy koala and you dropped it in the sea. Was that actually true?
That is absolutely true. The toy koala did get dropped in the sea. The toy koala got retrieved, so no koalas were lost in the making of my childhood.
Because when I was doing the research for the series, I listened to quite a lot of podcasts, and there was a brilliant one about, I think it was kind of basically Australian feminist heroes for children. And so it was entirely structured around your loss of the koala. And so I wasn't sure whether they just kind of made it up to get the children in or not. So that's wonderful to know. I also wanted to ask, are there any other Australian themes that you'd like us to cover? Is there any kind of burning topics that you think we should be doing on The Rest Is History?
Yeah, I'm not sure that you've done so much Australian history. I think there's plenty more for you to do. Heading in Australia towards a referendum on recognising the voice of Indigenous Australians in our constitutional structures. So the history around Indigenous Australia, the big moments in terms of what has happened with land rights, with reconciliation, that might make an interesting episode. I'm not sure you've really looked at some of the huge conflicts from our perspective, World War II, what that means in terms of the American alliance and the like. But I'd like you to have a bit of fun as well. So maybe Australian culinary traditions, Australian football, the history of all of those could loom large on future episodes of the podcast. I can send some Vegemite and stuff like that to get you started.
I mean, we have done an episode on Australia's defeat in the Ashes in 1981. So we have covered that, and we did an episode on Australia before Captain Cook, which was fascinating. You know, all the megafauna and the question of whether the Portuguese arrived and the Chinese and all that kind of stuff. So that was, but there's loads more. We do have one episode recorded on the Somerton Man. Do you know that extraordinary case of the man found propped up on a beach outside Adelaide?
Yes.
And there was a kind of incredible breakthrough in the case this summer. And it's all, you know, the theories is that it's all tied in with Russian spies or Mossad or whatever. So we do have that coming up, but we would love to do more Australian themes. And especially now that you are definitely not just our top Australian Prime Minister, but our top Prime Minister, full stop. So absolutely wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for joining us. We are very, very honoured.
I think I've just got two very big and probably very undeserved promotions, but I'll take that. Thanks, Tom.
Back them.
I will.
Well, that was very, very exciting. The first time we've had an actual historical personality on the show. Obviously, I don't want to do this on my own. Dominic isn't here. Julia Gillard has gone off to do prime ministerial things. So another historic figure, a man of towering presence and authority, Jack Davenport. Welcome back.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me back on. I look forward to my own episode of the rest of history yeah. as a protagonist. Yeah, I mean that must go down as one of the most confusing starts to any episode of the rest is history, given that you haven't appeared on the bonus pod for about a month. No. Last week there was no bonus pod at all because poor Dominic was unwell, and then suddenly we just popped straight in with the former Prime Minister
with the 27th Prime Minister of Australia,
Julia Gillard. Just for a little bit of explanation, Julia Gillard was appearing on our sister podcast, The Rest Is Politics, with Alistair Campbell. So throughout that conversation you just heard with Julia Gillard, also on screen was Alistair Campbell, who was
marking it, wasn't it? But I mean, before I began it, he said, well, you know, you mustn't go on too much. I don't want it boosting the ratings or anything. He is the world's most competitive man.
Yeah, exactly. Just to explain what happened, we got an email from Julia Gillard, just out completely out of the blue, or someone purporting to be Julia Gillard, and we weren't sure whether it was her or not. But she said that she's a wang. She's a massive fan of the show. So Tom just hijacked the end of that interview and popped yeah. up, and that was lovely.
Yeah, well, it was very exciting. Very exciting.
And I was trying to think of who else that we could surprise confront you with, who you've spoken about on the podcast.
It's General Gordon.
Who would be the worst person for you to be confronted with, having spoken about them on the pod?
Probably Lloyd George, I guess.
Oh yeah,
Dominic's always been rude about him, isn't he?
Oh, he's had a terrible time.
Who, like Julie Gillard, is a Welsh Prime Minister?
Hmm, good thing.
Yeah.
So Tom, I mean, you've been away for a month from the bonus pod. What have you been up to?
Well, basically, I've been on holiday, and I don't want to go on about it because there's nothing. I suppose the only thing that's more boring than people talking about holidays is people talking about their dreams. I may have mentioned this. I had a book to do, so I have hard actually earned. Been working. I have been working very, very hard, and so. We had a cricket tour to Corfu. I top scored in the final match. So that was a great success. And then we just had 2 weeks doing nothing. I mean, for the first time ever, basically, we didn't go to any ruins, any museums, anything like that. We just lazed. There was one day where I made the girls walk up a mountain to an abandoned village.
Very good.
So that was the tax they had to pay on their relaxation. So we did that. But otherwise, it was just 2 weeks. But what I did, Jack, and I'm sure we'll come onto this in due course, was I took the advantage to read some stuff that I'd been wanting to read for a long time. And I got given years ago by my parents, it must have been 2003, 2004, something like that, as a Christmas present, this huge, huge volume by N.A.M. Rogers, who is, you know, great, great historian of the Royal Navy. And it's about 700 pages long. And I'd wanted to read it for years and years and years, and I'd never had the time. So I thought, I will read it this time, because I knew we were going to be doing the Battle of Trafalgar. So I thought it would be interesting kind of prep for it. Anyway, I got completely hooked. It's such a great book. It's so entertainingly written, and it's so full of stupefying detail that I then just fell down a Royal Navy in the Age of Nelson wormhole. as people who've listened to the episodes on the Battle of Trafalgar may have realized. And basically, all my complaints about, you know, rope being boring, I completely recant. We'll come on to that in a minute, though, so I should just finish what else I've been doing. I then went from Greece to Venice because my mother, who suddenly announced she'd always wanted to go to Venice and had never been. So my cousin and I laid on a trip there, and it was really great because I'd been to Venice twice before. The first time when I went interrailing, so I had no money, so I couldn't afford to do anything. And the second time was when Sadie and I, we went for 6 months to Greece with our two daughters, who were very, very young. And we came back on the car ferry and stopped off in Venice. And I think our elder daughter was three, our younger daughter was 3 months, and Jack, you'll know. I mean, you can imagine what it's like going to this
not a fun trip at that
this
age.
City full of great art galleries and churches with two very small children.
Yeah, how's the soft play scene in Venice?
It was awful. It was, well, because Venice is all, you know, canals, obviously,
yeah,
and very steep steps. So the opportunities for young children basically to kill themselves is quite high. And anyone who's seen Don't Look Now, you know, it's actually not the reason Don't Look Now, where people who haven't seen the film, it's a couple who are haunted by the ghost of their drowned child, or are they? I mean, Venice is quite a kind of ghostly haunted place, I think. But this time it was fantastic because my mother wanted to experience Venice in its full glory. We could do everything that we'd secretly wanted to do, but were too cool to have done before. So we went in a gondola, you know, we went and drank cocktails on the roof terraces of very expensive hotels. Yeah, it was brilliant.
We should let the members in on it's a sort of a dream series that we've been plotting for a while, where we go around some of the coolest cities in the world doing episodes. Venice would be a great one to do, I'm sure.
It'd be really good, wouldn't it?
We'd need someone to pay for it.
Yes. So we'd go and do a sweep through the history of the city, a focus on various aspects of it, a bit like the London one we did.
Yeah, exactly. But out and about. So, you know, we'd get the gondola, the water running past the side, all that sort of stuff.
Of course, I mean, we don't have to go to Venice to do an episode on Venice. There's so much Venetian history.
Very true.
And that, you know, I was definitely left enthused by that as well. So, so it's been great. But I am back now and ready for the fray.
Yeah, normal service resume next week, hopefully with Dominic back from holiday. And we've got a live episode next week, haven't we, on the evening of the first live stream. So get that in your diaries now.
Yes. So that is that's coming up. We've got notes from Sam here, and he's asked me to say what I did on my holiday. So I've done that. But he also highlights, so as lots of you will know, when Dominic isn't doing his podcasts, he is also opining in the pages of the Daily Mail, his hot takes on British politics. And his hot take over the weekend was that Penny Mordaunt would become Prime Minister.
Well, I don't know if it was I don't think he was predicting she would. I think he said she should
become Prime Minister, which is kind of shameless, isn't it, really? I mean, it's so transparent that he's pitching for a peerage. Because he was laughing at me for, you know, that I'd be on the Liz Truss one, but...
You gotta back one of the horses, and you know if it comes good, then your quid's in. I mean, it's probably good for us that Mordaunt didn't get in, because you know he would be shuttled straight into Downing Street, into the cabinet, some sort of SPAD role.
Or do you think? I mean, Defence Secretary or Education Secretary? Just make everybody read his history books for children. So this is what he said in his Daily Mail column. He said that by far, so the Tories, their most formidable standard bearer among the general public would be the former Royal Navy Reservist and Defence Secretary, Penny Mordaunt. And Penny Mordaunt then used it on her official Twitter account, which I thought was slightly the measure of how few heavyweight backers she'd got. that basically her most heavyweight backer was Dominic. And I'm not in any way dissing Dominic. You know, any prime ministerial candidate would be honoured to have the backing of such a distinguished historian.
I think I'm right in saying that Penny Mordaunt wrote a book called Greater Britain Britain After the Storm. Penny Mordaunt and Chris Lewis wrote the book. I assume it's about, you know, how Britain can improve after Brexit. The foreword's by Bill Gates. The first cover quote is utterly uplifting and inspiring, Sir Richard Branson. And the second cover quote is smart, thoughtful, and passionate, Dominic Sandbrook. So there's history there.
There's something going on there, isn't there? What could it be? Who knows? Anyway, watch this space. Because I imagine Rishi he'll be gone, what, in 2-3 weeks? So Penny might be in. She might be in with a chance then. And actually, this is very, going back to Julia Gillard, this is all very Australian, isn't it? Australian prime ministers knifing each other in the back and things. And that's very much what's going on at the moment.
And you've got the Royal Navy link as well with Mordaunt. So it's right on theme.
Well, I hope that Dominic will, you know, when he becomes Education Secretary or whatever, will point out to Penny that I'm quite keen on the Royal Navy now. So perhaps there might be a role for me too. Anyway, we can but hope.
Let's get into Trafalgar, Tom, because there were some of my favourite episodes ever. I'm a huge Patrick O'Brien, Jack Aubrey series fan, and it gave me such joy to hear your enthusiasm in going through the history of the Navy in that era. And I think it was the more contextual stuff that I hadn't really thought of in that way, that I think you made the comment about the dockyards in, you know, Portsmouth and Plymouth being almost, you know, 80 years before the Industrial Revolution being the kind of start of the assembly line and stuff. I just thought it was fascinating.
Roger had this kind of amazing phrase, and I slightly paraphrase, where he said that Portsmouth and Chatham and so on were like islands of the 19th century set amid an 18th century sea. And that idea of the Royal Navy as essentially the incubator of modernity. So Dan Snow's very keen on this. He's often talked to me about it, and I've basically just blanked it. And not because I wasn't interested, but because I knew that the guy to read on it would be Roger and this huge book. And it was sitting there approaching. So it's just one of those books that I'd been looking forward to reading literally for years.
Yeah.
And it really didn't disappoint. And as I said, I just wanted to read more and more about it. And I love it when you get that kind of rush of pure joy in scoping out an area of history that you kind of know well enough. You know, you're aware of the parameters. It's not like you're struggling to get a handle on it, but you just know it's so full of fascination. And that's what I did. So all I did was basically read books about Nelson, Trafalgar, the Navy. You can imagine how well this went down with my wife and children. Here's another amazing fact about Nelson. But they kind of got into it too. Sadie's very into Nelson. So when we got back, we went to Greenwich, the Maritime Museum, which we've been to before.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been to, you know, three or four times. It's this kind of staple of harassed parents taking their small children out. I don't know. I mean,
the first museum I ever took Susie to, my 6-month-old. Yeah. At the time.
Well, there you go. We've all been there. But again, it's kind of great when you go to something you kind of know, but you actually have immersed yourself in the subject, and suddenly stuff that you kind of pass by in a blank way, you go, "Oh my God, they've got that! Yeah. They've got that painting there. They've got that sword. Oh my God, it's a Carolade! Wow, look at this!
They've got Nelson's uniform that he wore that day.
I know, with the bullet hole."
He's only a small chap, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He's a figure where I can kind of park my responsibilities to question received wisdom and just enjoy his status as a hero. I mean, I know that in all kinds of ways, you know, which we touched on in the episode, his attitudes to slavery, his lack of concern for that, all that kind of stuff. He perhaps isn't quite as much a hero to contemporary Britain as he would have been 100 years ago. But I still think that his courage, his dash, his charisma, his glamour makes him such a heroic figure. And that's really manifest, I think, in that exhibition. And also just in the sheer range of tat that you can get, Nelson-themed tat. So I got a Battle of Trafalgar mug. I got an Admiral Collingwood mug. Sadie's getting me a print of Nelson for Christmas. I mean, there's just, you know, there's so much stuff.
Well, from the Aubrey and Maturin novels, one of the big questions of the era is whether you should wear your captain's hat athwart ships.
Yeah.
In the traditional, I believe that's the traditional fashion, which is sort of sideways.
Yeah.
Or fore and aft, so it's pointing forwards. I think that's the modern fashion. Which would you go for?
I would do whatever Nelson did, and he wore it crossways, didn't he? In that famous painting.
Yeah, exactly.
I think if in doubt, do what Nelson does. And have you been to the painted? Have you been to the painted hall, Jack? Which is also incredible.
No, I haven't. I haven't. It's not far from there, is it?
That's brilliant. So that was shut for ages. They were refurbishing it. This is part of the kind of the great complex of naval buildings that stretches south from the Maritime Museum in Greenwich towards the Thames. And it was really the heartbeat of the Navy through its kind of golden age.
Yeah, you had to go there for the lieutenant's exam.
Yes, all that kind of stuff. And there's this huge hall painted with a frankly very vulgar series of paintings showing Charles II and Queen Anne and George I hanging out with the Greek gods. And in a way, it's as ridiculous as it sounds, but it's very, very impressive. And there's a room to the side that's called the Nelson Room, where his body was brought, and they laid it out for several weeks as they prepared the painted hall for his lying in state. And then it lay there for 3 days, kind of like a bit like the Queen. People came and filed past and showed their respects. And it kind of brought home really how Nelson is still massively a name to play with, I think. I think he still has that kind of resonance. Even though people don't really study him in history, do they? I mean, not in schools.
I think it will have been... It's one of those areas that people kind of know a little bit and they kind of know the story, but they don't really. So I think those are some of our, those are some of the episodes that I enjoy the most where it's, you think you should know more than you actually do. I mean, it got great feedback just coming through some of the comments that we had. Tom Boat History Golding, how utterly, utterly splendid. As someone who dabbles as a naval historian, I have to say, seeing Tom's new enthusiasm for the subject is really enjoyable. Stephen Clark, come on, Goalhanger, it's time for a new podcast. The Rest is Rope, an epic survey of Napoleonic naval warfare on an operational level in 3,000 episodes. And Perkin Warbeck is got another suggestion for some merch. Tom boiling the tactics down to get up close and blast the shit out of them. Another strong candidate to go on a mug or a t-shirt.
Are we going to do tat? Marketing, merchandising tap.
You know, again, this is for members only chat here, but we are going to try and get some merch up and running in time for Christmas. I mean,
that'd be good.
What better stocking filler material than
get up close and blast the shit out of them?
Yeah, exactly.
The Kaiser wearing the wrong shoes. All the favorite stuff.
All the classics. Yeah. I mean, send in your suggestions on Discord and on email.
Definitely.
And we had a question here, Tom, from Anthony Sanders. I thought he would give a little bit of gentle pushback to make things interesting. Is it really the case that the 19th century would have been entirely different if the naval maneuverings of the previous few years had gone differently? Would it have even been likely? Say Napoleon had ravaged British ports and knocked out much of the Navy. In short term, yes, it would have been a terrible blow and assisted Napoleon on the continent. But does it mean he would have eventually conquered Russia and held on to all of Europe indefinitely?
Well, so first, I mean, completely upfront, not a specialist in Napoleonic Wars or 19th century history. What I will say is that when you study a period, you get massively enthused. You always say it's incredibly important. So every book I've ever done, I always say, this is the pivot. This is the key. You can't understand anything without, you know, looking at this period or this angle or whatever. And it's not that I'm kind of lying or exaggerating or making it up. I genuinely think that because I'm so gripped by enthusiasm for something that it just seems to me colossally important. And I do genuinely think that it's a sense of the Navy as the kind of the matrix from which modernity comes. So we talked about the, you know, industrialization in the dockyards, but also all that amazing stuff about, you know, the epidemiology and healthcare and public health and all that kind of stuff emerging from it. So there's that. I also think that Britain's ability to control the shipping lanes was obviously key to the way that the British Empire evolves and then is maintained. So if you think that the British Empire has a global significance, which I think it plainly does, then Trafalgar, I think, is really important. And Britain's control of the seas is really important. But I think on top of that, it's, you know, we talked in the episode how really there were three political systems at play at Trafalgar. There was the Ancien Regime of Spain, you know, all their ships with theological names, the names of saints. I mean, it's a much more antiquated system. Then you've got revolutionary France. And then you have Britain, this bourgeois state that is going through the process of industrialization, a parliamentary democracy. And it's that gets exported to Canada, to Australia, to New Zealand, circuitously to India. And so I think the look of the modern world would be very, very different had the Royal Navy lost control of the seas. And I think that had Napoleon succeeded in crossing to Britain and knocked out the dockyards and basically gelded the Royal Navy, I think it would have been very difficult to get the Royal Navy back up again. Because just as if you control the seas, Britain's island status makes it impregnable. So if you lose control of the seas, it makes it a prison.
Yeah, I mean, there's no Indian colony, there's no Raj period without the Navy. I mean, they had what was it called, the at that time, the double standard.
Yeah, they have to have twice the twice the number of all other feats combined.
Yeah, I mean, it's I just find the whole period just so enchanting. It's just one of those parts of history that you think, like, you know, humans managed to create these boats that would, you know, go on multi-year voyages, just entirely made of wood, sail around the world several times, navigate by the stars. And it's just one of these amazing parts of human knowledge that is probably now, you know, lost or irrelevant.
And this is so evident in every account of Trafalgar. It's the courage required, you know, on both sides at Trafalgar. The courage and the kind of the qualities of heroism that are slightly old-fashioned virtues now, and there's not much scope for them in, say, history curriculums until Penny Mordaunt appoints Dominic as her education secretary, of course. So we watched we came back from Greenwich, and then the following evening we watched Master and Commander, which I have always loved, even though I've found the books impregnable. I did think that was a really great film, and it was interesting that we've got lots and lots of people in their early 20s staying with us at the moment, and they'd never seen it, and they were incredibly gripped by it as well.
Well, I think one of the things that I just had no appreciation for at all when I started to learn about the period was how young the officers would you know, go on their first voyage. You know, Nelson was probably, you know, he's probably 10, and has to do 2-3 years as a volunteer, and then you get made into a you get commissioned as a midshipman, which is like the lowest rank of officer. But what that means is that you're 13 years old and you are, as an officer, commanding, you know, the small unit of men, you know, 10, 12, 20, you know, 20 men under your command as a 13-year-old boy going into battle and potentially boarding a ship, or, you know, and you've got these 13-year-olds telling them to reload the cannons. And
do you remember the midshipman in Master and Commander in the film?
Babington.
He loses his arm.
Of course, yeah.
And then, you know, truckles down and just goes off collecting beetles, which I think is an example to any of our younger listeners out there.
Look, I mean, you know, Tom, I know it's probably got to the stage of, I know when people recommend you think something over and over, and you kind of react against it, but the Patrick O'Brien series is just so wonderful. And you know, on the language and the ropes and that sort of thing, you've just got to view it in the same way as you'd view something like, you know, I know you're a huge James Joyce fan. Just let the language wash over you, because it's not really about like what rope does what. It's just about the kind of, you know, the atmosphere and the scene. And, you know, just as, forget all the adventure, just as a writer of the human condition, Patrick O'Brien is just absolutely wonderful. So, you know, heartily, heartily recommend you read it. And now, what better time than now to start?
Well, there are two reasons why I might well give it a go. The first is that I now see the rope itself, I remain bored by. I'm still not interested in rope, but the system that can create this rope and the uses that it's put to, I now recognize as being thrilling. And the kind of the awareness of these ships as the most kind of technically advanced, most delicate, most lethal structures on the planet, you know, it makes it all actually incredibly fascinating, fascinating. And the other thing actually that makes me want to go back to it is, listeners will know that we're doing this series of programs themed around the 32 countries in the World Cup that's coming up in November. So we're about halfway through that now. And I am doing Ecuador. And so I'm going to do Darwin's visit to the Galapagos Islands. And it's very clear, I mean, I don't know whether it's the same in the book, but in the film, Aubrey turns up on the Galapagos Islands.
Yeah.
And it's pretty clearly that is modeled on Darwin's trip and the relationship that he has with Fitzroy, his captain on the Beagle. And there's all this kind of, oh, if only I could stay, I would work out the theory of evolution kind of vibe to the whole sequence. But I've been reading quite a lot about the Galapagos Islands, coincidentally, and I'd forgotten that features in the film.
Pops up. So they have to take him ashore to repair a bullet wound or something like that. Is that what happens?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. But it's kind of, it's a favor. It's pretty clear it's a favour being done to
him. Well, the book, the film is an amalgamation of a couple of the books. Aubrey's companion, Stephen Maturin, is a great naturalist, so that there's plenty of that.
Yes, so a bit of Darwin. So that is to come. Another message from Stephen Clark, who's clearly on fire, and he says, the podcast is nearly 2 years old. Congratulations. Thank you very much. If you have the chance to start again, what would you do differently? Which have been your favourite episodes to do and the most fun stories to tell? If the podcast is still around in October 2024, what do you hope to have achieved by then? Well, that's a lot of questions. What would we do differently? I don't think we'd do anything differently, really, because the fun of doing a podcast is that it is trial and error.
Yeah, we've worked it out along the way, haven't we?
Yes. So somebody was on the Discord was saying, why aren't there any jokes about the New Romantics? Because we did an episode on 1981, very, very early. It must have been our fourth or fifth episode, I think. And we said, oh, we should try and work in, you know, quotations from Duran Duran or Spandau Ballet or something. And we did it for a couple of episodes and then it just died the death. And that I realized looking back that was, you know, we were trying too hard with that.
I think I probably said at the time as a relatively experienced, you know, radio and audio producer now.
We're not going to keep that going.
Getting tied into a gimmick early doors is just always a recipe for disaster.
And what then happened was that kind of running jokes emerged more organically.
Yeah, and that's the best
way. So I think that the first two were actually both came in the episode we did on the cause of the First World War. And there was the one about Dominic being left wing. Leading Marxist historian. And there was the one about the Kaiser wearing the wrong shoes.
Yes.
Which is obviously run and run and run.
Indeed. I pitched it as part of our attempt to get a sponsor on board, a shoe company on board. I said, well, you know, we have a running joke about Thomas Footwear.
So it didn't work.
The Wangs will never hear it if it ever comes off. But it's an American shoe brand who are thinking about sponsoring the podcast. So
that'd be brilliant. Oh God, I hope we get that. We'd have so much fun with that. I think things that go wrong are, in a way, as important as things that go right in terms of working out what works and doesn't, up to a point. Would have been your favourite episodes to do? Well, I love doing Trafalgar. I love doing that third one.
That was great.
I think the episodes where you're talking about things that you know about, that you've written about or researched, are always fun. But in a sense, you're reheating yesterday's dinner. And also there's a slight pressure that people expect you to know everything and to get everything right. I think the thing about the Trafalgar was it was completely fresh in my mind and I felt completely excited about it. And I hope that sense of excitement came across. One of the enjoyable things about doing the podcast is the chance to research stuff that you wouldn't otherwise do. And there's something about, you know, you can be very interested in a subject, but if you know, anyone who's been to university and written essays will know this, that there's something about having to make notes, think about it, kind of write it or talk about it or whatever. You understand it better because it leads you to kind of follow threads, follow trails of rope, perhaps I should say, and you get to know it better. But obviously something like Trafalgar, there are massive Trafalgar nerds out there. There are people who know everything about this. So this is why we hadn't done it before. We just didn't have time to do the necessary research.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the encouraging things about the fact that by and large, we haven't been lambasted for getting too many things wrong is that we will be able to do similar treatments on other areas of history that we've always, both of us, been very interested in, but haven't had the time necessarily up till now to really research.
Yeah, for sure. So, and I mean, you know, I think your research we've already been proven in this episode that your koala story about Julia Gillard was we've had first hand account that was true. So
yeah, well that's I'm pleased about that as well.
So Tom, just before we wrap up, let me just rattle through a few more of the piece of correspondence from this week. Joe Evans Green, why is Dominic so jealous of Tom's uncanny ability to impersonate any celebrity?
That's so true. I don't know what his problem is. I don't know what his problem. So this is Sam's roundup of stuff that I may have missed when I was away.
The reaction to Marilyn Monroe.
To Marilyn, yes. Okay, yeah. which Dominic led me to believe. I mean, he clearly only highlighted the one or two very few negative comments on it, because judging by the array of people quoted here, it was clearly an absolute smashing success. So
Well, Alfie Three Times says, I'm burning my copies of Persian Fire Dominion in the shadow of the sword and Rubicon after listening to the intro of the show. So I'm not sure about that.
Okay, well, that's, well, I don't know what Alfie's problem is. And Capel Loft, again, I mean, a notorious.
The creepiest bloody thing I ever heard.
Makes his Princes in the Tower sound like Nigella Lawson. Was he possessed by a demon?
I did instinctively just have to tear my headphones off for a second.
Well, yeah, but Albie Jr., not only did Tom sound like Marilyn, he also looked spookily like her. That's very charming.
I have to say, though, to be fair, I thought your Churchill just before that was actually really good. One of your
Thanks,
best,
Jack.
Actually.
Thank you, Jack. Like, would you know, I'd made the effort to listen to what he sounded like. And I realised he doesn't actually sound like people doing an impersonation of Churchill
right.
at all.
Yeah, you were just doing an impersonation of the impersonation.
Well, because I think people... as being, but actually, I mean, he's got this weird speech defect and he's essentially incomprehensible for large sections of the time.
Well, you nailed that.
If you listen to the, you know, the really famous speeches, the fighting them on the beaches and all that kind of stuff, it's quite hard to make out. Whereas you think, because he's the lion roaring, it's but actually it's not like that at all, and that I think is where Dominic goes wrong.
Pete Williamson, would Tom ever consider taking a coruscating one-man musical show to Edinburgh in which he plays Churchill and Marilyn while sitting on a stool on a bare stage? I wonder if they ever met.
Well, I gather that Dominic is actually quite keen on this, isn't he? He's offered to put £5,000 up to fund it. So, well, I might think about it.
We've been approached actually to do Edinburgh next year.
Yeah, we have. And unlike Dominic, I've been to the festival as well, the Fringe, and I think I got 4 stars for the 2 plays I put on. And Dominic, of course, Dominic got 1 star.
Mm.
So I have experience. No, freeze Dominic out because clearly, you know, he should learn from his errors. I have a track record of achievement at the Fringe. So yeah, I might think about that.
You don't want to sully it with the box office poison of Dominic's Ambrose.
Yes. A student in the wrong trainers does not the majesty of the medieval church evoke, or whatever that line was. I just think he'd let the podcast down, he'd let the audience down, but worst of all, he'd let himself down.
I think that's a good note to end on.
And next week, Dominic will be back and I'll be here and... the old band will get back together again. Bye.
Bye.